You know, this is sort of the culmination of about a year and a half of work to sort of get to this point of, you know, what's the right number, what's the right amount.
Alaska State Troopers are set to receive a pay raise. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 29th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, an Interior Department worker claims he was punished for being a whistleblower.
He refused to violate the law. He wouldn't make a false statement that the regulations had been.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Governor Bill Walker announced today that Alaska State Troopers are getting a pay raise at the start of next month. Walker made the announcement at the Troopers' Matsu West post near Wasilla, which he says has been hit hard by vacancies as troopers have left for better pay and benefits elsewhere. The troopers have been stretched thin around the state. The 7.5% raise takes effect September 1st. That's for more than 300 troopers, all except two colonels in charge. Walker says this raise does not require legislative approval because it's an amendment to an existing contract. But his administration is seeking an additional 7.5% increase, officials say would require legislative approval. Asked about the timing, Walker says the troopers have been facing a retention crisis. They now have more than 50 vacant trooper positions, and they need to be a competitive employer.
It's now because, you know, as we go into, another winter season, we have a big class coming out at the academy. You know, this is sort of the culmination of about a year and a half of work to sort of get to this point of, you know, what's the right number, what's the right amount.
Walker says the increase fits legislative intent in the state operating budget to increase trooper pay by 15% total. The troopers' union says the closest pay comparison was to the Anchorage Police Department. Depending on how long they've been with the department, comparable positions make 16 to 19% more. Walker says losing troopers to departments like APD or, say, King County in Washington means wasting the money spent training them and the loss of a great deal of experience.
This is about fixing what we have now, and there's a lot of I get a lot of input around the state about we need more troopers, and we certainly do. And I have nothing against King County, but I don't necessarily want us to do the training for King County, and that's what we've been doing.
Walker's Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan says the administration will pursue increasing the overall number of trooper positions while it addresses the vacancies. A public safety spokesperson says the department does not yet have a figure for the total amount of money the raise represents. A campaign spokesperson for Walker's Republican opponent for governor, Mike Dunleavy, said the Dunleavy campaign had no comment on the trooper pay increase. Now, a story about the U.S. Office of Special Counsel. Not the outfit investigating alleged interference in the 2016 election. This special counsel is a federal agency that protects whistleblowers, and it is supporting an Alaska employee who complained the Interior Department took shortcuts in its environmental review of Royal Dutch Shell's Arctic offshore drilling program. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
The special counsel's office announced Tuesday it's filing a whistleblower retaliation complaint with the Merit Systems Protection Board for Jeffrey Missale. He was an environmental officer in Anchorage with the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement within the Interior Department. The events date to the Obama administration, but the case is no doubt of interest to environmentalists who hope to derail future offshore exploration. The Trump administration has proposed to reboot ocean drilling in the Arctic with a series of lease sales starting as soon as next year. Missale started complaining in 2012 that the Interior Department was violating the rules for environmental review to allow Royal Dutch Shell to go ahead with its Arctic drilling plan. Tom Devine is the legal director of Government Accountability Project, a nonprofit representing Missale.
He refused to violate the law. He wouldn't make a false statement that the regulations had been obeyed. And he started blowing the whistle on it within the chain of command at the agency.
When those complaints didn't produce results, Devine says Ms. Sale went to the Interior Department's Inspector General.
Within a couple of hours of learning that Jeff had gone to the Inspector General, the agency opened up a retaliatory investigation of him.
Devine says Ms. Sale was taken off his job and put in a position with no duties. Some of the activity in Ms. Sale's case occurred during a particularly awkward period for the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, as well as its sister agency at Interior, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. In 2014, federal courts invalidated the environmental review of an Arctic lease sale known as Lease Sale 193. But the lease sale had already taken place, and while Interior was redoing its analysis to determine whether Lease Sale 193 was appropriate, employees of the agencies were working with Shell on its plans to explore and drill on acreage it attained in Lease Sale 193. Ms. Sale argued the Interior Department couldn't act as though the lease sale would be affirmed because the environmental reviews weren't complete. Ms. Sale was fired in 2016. Devine says Interior was later forced to temporarily reinstate him, though not to his old job.
So he's been essentially getting paid to fill up space for the last year.
Usually in cases like this one, whistleblowers try to settle with the government for full reinstatement or enough money to start fresh at a new job. But Devine says negotiations with Interior were unsuccessful. Interior Department spokeswoman Heather Swift says the department can't comment on the matter because it's in litigation. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Two Alaska newspapers initially misreported who was eligible to vote in the primary election last week. And it turned out that fewer than 100 votes could have made the difference in some races in one paper's area. The Kenai-based Peninsula Clarion reported on the morning of the primary that voters registered in one of Alaska's official political parties could vote. However, those who are registered as nonpartisan or undeclared also can vote either primary ballot. The Sitka Sentinel misreported that only Republicans could vote in the Republican primary. Sentinel editor and co-publisher Thad Polson says the error was based on information on who is eligible to be candidates.
From reading the sample ballots, which say what parties or what candidates are eligible to be on that ballot, we took that to mean these are the voters who are eligible to vote that ballot. Of course, that isn't correct.
None of the Sitka elections were close. But on the Kenai Peninsula, the Republican race for Senate District O was separated by a single vote at one point on election night. As of today, Senate Majority Leader Peter Michicki leads challenger Ronald Gillum by 72 votes. And in the Republican contest for House District 29, Ben Carpenter still leads Wayne Ogle by only 13 votes. So back to who can vote on what ballot. The two ballots have different rules about that, and the political parties have different rules about who can run on their ballots. The Democratic, Libertarian, and Alaskan Independence parties allow anyone registered to vote to cast a primary ballot. The Democratic Party allows Democrats, undeclared, and nonpartisan candidates to run in its primary. In contrast, the Alaska Republican Party allows registered Republican, nonpartisan, and undeclared voters to cast ballots. Only Republicans can run in its primary. Both the Peninsula Clarion and Sitka Sentinel published corrections. The Clarion posted a correction online the morning of the primary, while the Sentinel published a correction in print the day before the primary. Alaska Division of Elections spokesperson Samantha Miller notes the division provided clear information to the public and to the news media about the primary.
Elections are complex by nature, and each party has their own rules, which is why we do make attempts to make ourselves available to talk with media.
She also says that the rules about who can vote are posted at voting locations. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Assembly votes for a plastic bag ban.
The fact is that the waste stream is voluminous, and we have an opportunity now to break that cycle.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Landing a job in Alaska's high-demand industries like welding, construction, medical billing, or marine transportation is now more affordable. The University of Alaska has reduced tuition for more than 300 career and technical education courses by 25%. From Ketchikan to Kotzebue, there has never been a better time to get started on your path to a new career. Learn more at www.alaska.edu/starthere. This message brought to you by the University of Alaska.
Anchorage is joining a growing list of communities around Alaska in banning plastic bags. During a meeting last night, the Anchorage Assembly overwhelmingly voted to phase out disposable plastic bags within 6 months. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
As the bag ban has made its way through the Assembly, there's been general support for the ordinance among members, but pointed disagreement about the specifics. Ahead of the 9-2 vote, there was a major split over how severe the ban ought to be, and there were differences on the timeline for implementing it. Assemblymember Chris Constant pushed aggressively for a tougher version of the measure, one that bars retailers from giving or selling even thicker, multi-use plastic bags at the point of sale.
The fact is that the waste stream is voluminous, and we have an opportunity now to break that cycle.
That tougher version of the ordinance narrowly won out. Under the new rules, retailers can sell customers paper or heavy-duty reusable bags, but they'll face fines if they give out thin, single-use plastic ones. One of the members who lobbied hardest for the milder ban was John Weddleton, a business owner who spoke of the harsh retail environment stores in Anchorage are facing. Though Weddleton's more moderate version was voted down, he still supported the overall measure.
I think this is an extreme ban here. More than we needed, but I don't think it's a crisis for anyone if you're concerned about it.
Though just under half the assembly supported a milder version of the ban, one of the most direct positions offered against a moderate approach came from Lily Sporosky, the youth representative who sits on the body. Sporosky says she reached out to peers in person and through polls on Instagram.
And a majority of them are in support of a downright all-out plastic bag ban.
In spite of opting for stricter provisions, the new ordinance does have a number of allowances for different plastic bag variations, like the kind you get for vegetables, newspapers, meat products, dry cleaning, and ice. Those and many others will still be allowed. From Wasilla to Koyuk, there are more than a dozen communities spanning the state that have enacted similar measures in recent years. Within the municipality, the bag ban goes into effect March 1st. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Anchorage police have arrested several suspects wanted for months in an August 2017 beating that left a man with brain, skull, and hand injuries. Police on Sunday arrested 28-year-old Fa'amanu Vaifanua, who goes by Junior, and 29-year-old MacArthur Vaifanua. A third suspect, 25-year-old Rex Faumui, was arrested Monday night at the Anchorage Cemetery without incident. The three were indicted on charges of attempted murder, kidnapping, and assault in the beating of 34-year-old Abshir Muhammad, who was stomped, beaten with a baseball bat and metal broom handle, and delivered to a hospital in an animal cage. Police found Junior Vaifanua at a home near Lake Otis Parkway and 88th Avenue. He was arrested as he tried to flee. MacArthur Vaifanua turned himself in a few hours later at the Anchorage jail. Federal agencies have completed the first high-resolution mapping of a fast-moving underwater tectonic fault that extends from Vancouver Island, Canada to southeast Alaska. The Ketchikan Daily News reports researchers from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the U.S. Geological Survey finished the comprehensive mapping of the 746-mile Queen Charlotte Fairweather Fault System, aiming to help coastal communities prepare for earthquakes and tsunamis with the data. Scientists gathered an in-depth look at the seafloor from April through July along the strike-slip fault line, which is a fault that moves side to side. Peter Hausler, a research geologist with the Geological Survey, says that among the uses for the data, it will be incorporated into updates for the seismic hazard map for the state. Well, GCI's more than 100,000 customers will no longer have to download a special app to get wireless emergency alerts pushed to their cell phones. In January, a late-night magnitude 7.9 earthquake and subsequent threat of a tsunami prompted warnings from state and federal emergency alert systems. There were no serious injuries reported, but the rumbling uncovered several flaws in how the alerts go out. Shortly after the earthquake, as many GCI customers wondered why they hadn't gotten alerts automatically on their phones, the company said it was still working to update its systems. GCI now says its iPhone users will need to update their carrier settings to get those alerts and may have already received a message notifying them of the available update. One of the biggest gold mines in the world could be built in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. How the company Donlin Gold will clean up after it's closed and pay for it was the subject of a public hearing last night at the Bethel Cultural Center. Christy Schallenberger with Alaska's Energy Desk was there to cover the meeting and brings us this report.
It took nearly 4 hours, and in that time, nearly 30 people filled the room to express their views about the proposed Donlin Gold Mine.
Oh, what I'm putting up here is Andronymous Fish Inventory Wildlife Refuges Yukon Delta Coastal Summary from 1975.
That's Alyssa Rogers, stacking books. She's one of the founders of the Yukon-Kuskokwim River Alliance, a local organization that opposes the mine. And she's one of several who testified against the mine during the public hearing.
This is a sustainable subsistence economy. It always will be. It always has been.
The hearing was held at the Alliance's request, and the public comments were supposed to be focused on the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation's draft approval of the plans for reclaiming Donlin's mine site, which is upstream from Crooked Creek, and also how Donlin plans to pay for cleanup. But most of the comments were broader. That's William Charlie Brown. He's an elder from Eek who spoke in Yukten about where he stands on the mine. He's against it. He is afraid that a mine accident would contaminate the Kuskokwim River and its tributaries, which are vital food sources for the entire YK Delta. The Donlin mine itself would impact about 3,500 acres of wetlands and permanently eliminate two salmon streams. And so Donlin is required by law to pay for cleanup and to restore the land. But many in the hearing were skeptical about the amount that the state would require Donlin to pay. That is $317 million. State documents put the actual cost to clean up the mine much higher, more than $1 billion. And because the mine is being built on Native Corporation land, it's even more complicated, especially about who is responsible if Donlin goes bankrupt and there isn't enough money for the state to reclaim the site. Alan Nakanishi is the technical engineer for DEC's mining division.
It'll end up in the courts, and it's unpredictable.
So this would seem to put two Native corporations under pressure to make sure there is enough money set aside by Donlin, just in case. The Chilista Regional Native Corporation owns the subsurface rights to the mine site and didn't provide any comments during the hearing. Maver Carey, the CEO of the Kuskokwim Corporation, which owns the surface rights, was the only representative from a Native corporation who spoke at the hearing. Her comments focused on the TKC's responsibility to return value to its shareholders.
Responsible economic development is a critical factor for our corporation. Responsibly developing our land and resources was the intent that our forefathers and founders identified when selecting lands, including mineral-rich lands, for the betterment of all TKC shareholders.
It appears unlikely that many public comments opposing the mine will stop the state from approving the reclamation plan and the amount Donlin would pledge to clean up the site. The state agency personnel say it's rare that a permit is denied. DEC's Nakanishi says that he's worked at the agency for 10 years, and he's never saw a permit in his division that got turned down. Meanwhile, the public can submit comments to DEC and the Department of Natural Resources until 5 p.m. on September 6th. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Stronghearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Some Fairbanks area high schoolers got a chance to get down and dirty last month as part of a class that helps them learn how archaeologists uncover the past. The students spent a week excavating artifacts at a dig near Quartz Lake as part of a University of Alaska Fairbanks program that gives young people hands-on experience with science, technology, engineering, and math-related activities. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
What's going on here? What are you doing?
I'm looking for stuff in the dirt.
Hutchison High School ninth grader Eleanor Panamarov takes a break from excavating at an archaeological site just off the northern shore of Quartz Lake to explain why she's spending 2 weeks of her summer vacation digging in the dirt looking for bits of bone and other artifacts.
My mom was an archaeologist, and so I kind of wanted to follow in her footsteps a little bit, and so far it's been pretty fun.
Debrana Beeler is an Eielson High School freshman who worked with Panamarov and a couple of other high schoolers at the dig. Beeler says she signed up for the Alaska Summer Research Academy, or ASRA, Archaeology Instructional Module because she wants a well-rounded education.
I'm not really that into archaeology. I want to be a lawyer, but like a lot of other things could be cool to like look at, you know, to like broaden your expertise on like everything so you know just like a little bit about everything.
Trinity Franz is a junior at West Valley High School who wants to be a veterinarian, and she says she took the two-week archaeology course that includes a week of fieldwork to learn about other science-related occupations.
I'm typically usually more interested in animal-like things, but at this young age where you're starting to decide college and kind of think about your future career, I wanted to get more experience with other careers.
And Brian Johnson is another West Valley student who's been involved with ASRA for a couple of years. He actually wants to be an archaeologist, and he's already landed a job at the university's Museum of the North that pays him to work in the field he loves.
I'm just working there over the summer, sorting and organizing artifacts in the range where we keep all our artifacts and everything, making sure it's all squared away and everything's in the database online.
That's the goal of ASRA's hands-on science, technology, engineering, and math-related instruction, says Program Director Krista Mulder, a professor of plant ecology at UAF.
The group that went to Quartz Lake, for example, they got to spend about 8 days out at the lake learning what a dig is really like, the whole process that archaeologists go through, what they actually do.
Mulder says the program offers courses that help middle schoolers and high schoolers start thinking about possible careers in science and technology.
It's a really great way to figure out whether you are really genuinely interested in an area of science or not.
Mulder says students interested in next summer's offerings should go to the ASRA page on the UAF website and read up on the program. She says registration will begin February 1st. Reporting from Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
One way to make money in a slow economy is to fill a gap in the market. But a local spice blend company is doing more than building bank accounts. It's also connecting people with Alaska native dishes in a new way. Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry has this story from our solutions desk.
Alicia Tangman cuts a dark red piece of bowhead whale meat into small cubes at her aunt and uncle's kitchen table in Wasilla. It's a marine mammal, but it smells like fresh fish.
So I use an ulu and I cut it in pieces.
The tail meat, known as ukukuk, or the flukes, tastes like sushi. Tangman passes it around the table to her aunt and uncle.
Well, I grew up on native food because coming from the village, everything at the store was so expensive. So we relied on caribou and whale and geese.
Tangman moved to Big Lake about 5 years ago from New Exit, but her relatives and friends bring her native foods when they visit from the North Slope. She says she wants her 3-year-old daughter to grow up loving the foods, unlike her nephews.
And then now they're older. They haven't had it since they were babies, and now they don't like it.
She used to eat the foods plain or with salt, but then she saw her friend sharing a Facebook group called Kunyak Spices, a spice blend company run by a woman from the North Slope. She added herself to the group page, and then she won a sample.
I use it on everything up there, even on salads and then in soups. And then with eating native food, it tasted even better.
The company's owner, Kunyak Hopson, moved to Chugiak 11 years ago from Utqiagvik, which she calls Barrow. When she was growing up, her family always put McCormick's salt and spice on muktuk, which is frozen whale blubber and skin. But then they stopped making it, and she had to find an alternative.
They kind of put their recipe online, and I took it from there and altered it just a little bit, you know, just to make it mine so I don't get in trouble.
At first, she was just making it for herself, but then her sister shared some with friends. Before Hobson knew it, people from other parts of the state were asking for the blend. She didn't have any business experience, but she taught herself QuickBooks and got a food worker's card.
And from there, I started my own whole line of spices, which I now have 11 different flavors.
Metal shelves stuffed with bulk spices line the walls of Hobson's kitchen. Flavors range from lemon to garlic to ghost pepper. Hobson stands at the head of a sturdy wooden table where she mixes spices and fills clear plastic containers decorated with forget-me-nots. She ships 300 to 500 bottles of spices a month to customers across rural Alaska and to Canada. Hobson's Facebook group has more than 1,400 followers. People post pictures daily, mostly of Alaska native dishes that they've paired with her spice blends. Business has nearly quadrupled in the last 6 months. And she says that's mostly because people share the page with friends and family, and she hosts giveaways. For now, the business primarily lives on Facebook. She says she doesn't have any plans yet to sell to restaurants or in stores, but she's open to the idea if the business keeps growing. Hobson works a full-time job, but sometimes spends 5 hours a day on the side business. And the hard work has paid off. The business has funded trips back home, most recently to sell her spices at the Inuit Circumpolar Council General Assembly meeting.
There's a lot of people that I have no idea who they are. They come up to me and say hi and tell me that they're one of my customers. And so it feels really good. It feels almost like a celebrity almost.
The best part, she says, is hearing how much people enjoy them, especially their kids. Like Tingman's daughter, Lucy. She darts in and out of the kitchen, stealing bites of muktuk dipped in Kunyak salt and spice blend, her favorite.
So we eat it together. She'll choose this over chips or junk food.
Finally, Lucy grabs an entire plate full of ruby chunks and takes it in front of the television, licking the salt and spice off her fingers after each bite. For the Solutions Desk, I'm Erin McKinstry.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin, Zachariah Hughes, and Erin McKinstry in Anchorage, Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
You know your teenager is struggling. Friends have changed. Grades have dropped. And when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.